There is such a massive gravitational pull to turning off security controls. Let's talk about like WAF. WAF breaks stuff like crazy. And 9 times out of 10, the solution is to turn it off.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Thanks for listening. Good to see you, Sunil. Mario, it's been a little while since we've been on the air, but not since we've been recording. It's just about Labor Day, and we're a little bit behind. It's tough to wrangle people like us. We're not professional podcasters. We're trying to run companies, but our intrepid producer, Tilson, manages to pull it off every couple weeks, and then Jerry has a fiber optic cable failure in the middle of a recording, and that put another damper on us. So, apologies to our audience. Thanks to those of you who reached out and made sure that we hadn't fallen off the face of the earth. And here we are back. So you've had a little time. What have you guys been up to? Sunil, are you actually sitting at home finally? And
I am not. I am in San Diego, sunny San Diego. I just came back from Tel Aviv. So my body clock is somewhere in the middle at the Atlantic right now.
Mario, though, you seem to be nailed down. Is the weather any better now in San Francisco?
It's been beautiful the last 3-4 days, and kids are back in school. Now we're doing all the parent dropping off kids at school, going to after hours school events with teachers. So
yeah, down here in Atlanta, our schools try to kick off on August 1st. And that was going to be a Friday this year, so it went to the 4th, but it's still really early. So I'm deep in this, and I will tell you, like, for the cyber angle, there's so many things that come on. Like, I just reached out to the CIO of the Atlanta Public School System to talk about some of this, and I'm going to try to get some research. I wonder if it's the same for you guys, but one thing I notice about my kids' school, from a cybersecurity perspective, is they use Google Workspace, They have single-factor authentication and nothing else and no options. And no password resets, and the passwords are 5-digit numbers, and that's it. But that's not the headline, because everybody, you know, our security folks like to roll our eyes. Everybody's so stupid. We know better. Let's go back to whatever we do all day. But that's never the right outcome, right? The real headline is, it's working, and it's fine. So it made me say, I want to interview this guy and talk about, and by the way, there's no conditional access, right? You could log into these accounts from anywhere. Anyone could harvest them and mass log into them and upload a lot of files that a lot of kids are going to see and are going to be socialized with them, which is my number one threat objective I'm concerned about. But time after time, no problems whatsoever. I think we can learn a lot from this as far as, like, I don't know, why do you think that this is working? Is it just blind luck and it's a time bomb? Or is it that there's nobody's targeting them and nobody really cares?
I would say it's the latter. The nature of who's targeting them would be commensurate with the level of controls that you've put in. But once someone comes up with a clever reason to attack them or attack that setup, then you have to increase your controls accordingly. But until then, it's sort of like, well, this is good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not upset about it. I mean, it's hard enough to get anything done. And whenever there is the notion of security and unique credentials or anything like that in school, it just, you know, devastates learning. it's the ultimate friction house. If you inject any friction at all, it's like, I always think of healthcare and academia as places where there's prima donnas that you can't mess with anything or they get upset. Well, you know, try a bunch of 7-year-olds. They're upset. They're just not getting it. And then the teacher is trying to help them.
The threat vector I would see that is most interesting would be other students attacking other students.
Yeah. Yeah. As a security practitioner, I feel like, you know, when I hear these passwords being 5 characters long and people are still using them, I just think of the song from the Smashing Pumpkins. Despite of my rage, I'm still just a rat in a cage. So there you go.
That's all I can
say about that.
Yeah, I can hear it right now. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, on a tech note here, though, I always say, like 12345 is not a bad password. If the person guessing, it starts at 00000 and then goes 11111 and 22222, and you lock them out after 10 tries. right? It's all about the trial factor. Like if you have hashes and you're cracking them offline and GPU rigged, then all this matters, right? Absolutely. Entropy like crazy. But if you only have one way to supplicate a guess and that route is limited at 10 tries, all the crap we proselytize about password security is completely moot. And that's totally the case here with the 5-digit passwords. They're working great.
The challenge with 5-character passwords is that they're easily observable.
5-digit, yeah.
Or 5-digit passwords.
Okay, go on.
Well, you're in a physical environment where students can are known to look over other people's shoulders and copy assignments. So if folks really wanted to capture a 5-digit password from another student, it would not be that hard.
What? There's cheating going on in school? I'm shocked. So, Neil, I'm shocked.
No, I don't think any kid that has access to a computer and the internet, which is required to be able to get to any of the school stuff, is going to log in to Paul's computer when they have ChatGPT and Google and the entire universe of the internet available. So that might actually have nullified that threat vector. Like, why would you even want
to? Oh, no, sorry. I wasn't suggesting that people will log into other students' accounts for cheating purposes, but rather for much more malicious purposes in the sense of ruining somebody's reputation or doing things that are just uncool.
Yeah. You know, I often, when it comes to proximity security, right, because We grew up kind of caring about that a lot, and I'm thinking about things like port security and making sure rogue devices can't be plugged into your LAN and all of that. Most of that really never manifested for anyone. You know, once the internet came and everybody could attack from a non-extradition country, then what I call stab domain security, you know, like being an adversary and doing something that requires getting close enough to be stabbed, like that just doesn't really happen very much. Like that is a control, implicit control. And I think that's true for kids too. Like if the kid's really Machiavellian and slick and they know how to cover their tracks, then what you're saying is totally true. And we know the motivation is there. Kids are catty and bad and everything in between. But I think most of them would just leave a trail of breadcrumbs that would get them busted. And
it's interesting you guys are saying this because during COVID, my oldest kid was, I think, either fifth or sixth grade, and they were starting to introduce the concept of username and passwords. Yes, believe it or not, fifth and sixth grade, maybe fifth grade. They weren't. And it's interesting because it's not like I'm a security. We're security professionals. You would think my kids would know anything about security after hearing all the stuff I talk about. That just goes to show you it goes nowhere. So, but it's interesting, the concept of user and passwords and protecting your identity is not natural, in my opinion, to kids. And my kid kept locking herself out. So they kept having to and she kept forgetting the name of the account. Not only the password, but her identity, she kept forgetting it. She really struggled. It was interesting. And as it turns out, it wasn't just my kid. When I went and talked to the tech people at the school, and they were saying, well, this is a problem that happens a lot. So it's interesting. Kids don't naturally think about identity and password and being guarded in that way.
One extra element I should add to the targeting question and why is what I described working right now is the user IDs have some random string attached to them, which is why they're forgetting them, like to your point, Mario. Yeah, I can't believe they actually remember them. But that might be what's saving their bacon, because not only is that username non-intuitive, but more importantly, like everything is non-intuitive. We find people's usernames and email addresses and all that because they're just plastered all over everything, right? If I Googled for Sunil and you, sorry to use you and prompt the world to do this, but I'm going to find at least 3 or 4 email addresses that are real for you and very quickly and then go on from there. But these kids don't have email. Thank God they don't have email. So they're not sending
They have
address
emails now, though. Jerry,
well,
they have
the ones
now.
I'm talking about at this age, they don't.
Yeah.
Which
is
awesome. And that might be why they're surviving.
So early in the formation of our company, we debated this, actually. Should we create email accounts that were not that had names that were not associated with us, right? So basically some obscure employee number or some character that a string of characters and numbers that don't correlate back to us. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to not go that route for a number of reasons. but we were debating the merits of something like that. It's very analogous, in my view, to phone numbers.
Yes.
Like, do I really care to know somebody's? I don't even know some of my kids' phone numbers because it's all indexed in my address book. So, in some respects, is it really important that we give people an email address that is actually guessable? If the desire here is to not enable any random person to email you, well, and I think in a school system that makes actually a lot of sense. You don't want some random, pedophile or whatever emailing somebody, right? Does it make sense in a corporate context? Maybe for salespeople, it makes a lot of sense. The engineer that doesn't really ever need to communicate with the outside world for whatever reason, I don't know, that maybe you create different tiers of people or different types of accounts here. So
I thought you were going to say that you debated whether or not to have email, which would have been kind of funny. And that day's coming.
You don't want to, from a business standpoint, you don't want to create you don't want to lock out a channel where there are people, potential buyers coming in through that channel, right? So that's the challenge there.
Marketing team just dropped the bomb, man. You're killing the marketing team here, Jerry. What do you mean no emails, man?
No, yeah.
What's marketing going to do after that?
Saying, I was accusing Sunil and Gotti of thinking about it. No, it wasn't me. Yeah.
But anyway, the point is, if we had email accounts that were not guessable, one, just the amount of spam that we get drops dramatically, right? All the stupid, I'm your CEO, send me your, contact me so that you can buy me gift cards. That whole threat vector largely goes away as well.
Yeah, I disagree with that first piece you said about the amount of spam going down. So I have so when I became a professor at Georgia Tech, shortly thereafter, I started doing a bunch of different consulting stuff and ended up being the interim CISO at Silicon Valley Bank, right? At some point, my Georgia Tech email address got associated with like the bankruptcy holding company of Silicon Valley Bank as the CISO of it. And I can't make effective use of my university email because of the volume of cybersecurity vendor spam that goes through it. So my point being, the private equity firm who's trying to do a roll-up in your space and wants to reach you would fail because they did guess first.last at your company name. And that's a reach out you probably want to hear about. And the spammer jackass who's going to harvest it because you actually signed up for some Eventbrite thing and you had to is going to hammer you. I think the obscurity only hurts the humans, and that's not what we need to be worried about. It's the automation and the bulk.
Yeah, ultimately, you're buying time before, because what happens right now is that you have a whole bunch of LinkedIn scraping happening almost right from the very beginning. So the point that you pointed out is that it eventually got sucked up into Zoom Info, into all these other marketing databases, and now you're starting to get spammed all over.
Yeah.
But it still is not an intuitive discovery process that most other spammers use to discover your email address as well.
Let me ask you a question. As security professionals, when is the last time that you received a pitch from a security vendor, a vendor that you didn't know about, pitching their product, and you said, oh, goodness, this is really interesting. I'm going to click on it. I'm going to go see and explore what this product's about. When's the last time you did that?
Yeah, never.
You mean via email?
Yeah. You get an email, but you respond. You review the email from the security vendor, and you're like, wow, really, I need to go look at this product. I should contact them. When's the last time you did that?
Very awful conversion ratio, because that's the question. Yeah. There have been a few emails that in life I've gotten over the last year where it piqued my interest about a product. It wouldn't have been cybersecurity. I mean, it was probably like, a bike thing or something like that. And even in those instances, I mean, you're probably the same way, Mario. I try to asynchronous, so to speak, on my reach out. I never click the link in the email that has all the tagging and the tracking links. I always think like I go and Google the company and find it independently. With enough time between when the mail, I really don't want them to say this is working. I don't want to feed the beast.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean,
but a security vendor, I work for a security vendor. You guys are security companies. Imagine having these conversations with marketing where they understand email really doesn't work, but you got these poor folks sending these things out there. I know.
Because it still works.
It's just too cheap. It still works. If it works at all, it's worth it, right?
But we just said right here, none of us can read. Yeah, I'm not going to say it. Yeah.
We have a smaller sample population here. You multiply us by 1,000 people and somebody's going to click.
You mean we don't represent the whole cyberspace community? What are you talking about? What?
Guy, no joke. I just pretty quickly brought up my Georgia Tech email. Since July 6th of this year, which is very recently, 24 emails from Qualys.
Oh, boy.
Qualys is
unsubscribe.
The worst. What's the point? It just says, more verified contact. You know, we increased the charge for this contact by 20%.
Zoom Info. Well, if you guys aren't familiar with zoominfo.com, very good about adhering to removal of.
Okay. I'm going to give it a shot on that address because it's kind of. It's a good use case. You know, that's the only email it gets except for,
you go to Zoom Info and you can opt out, say, don't send me this stuff. And they do that.
Zoom Info purges your contact information from all their databases if you go to their opt out.
Let's
page.
Go.
Oh, man, that's gold. I'm going.
Before we leave this general topic, Sunil, you mentioned something when we went into it, though, when we were talking about you guys ruminating about whether to obfuscate email addresses and make them not guessable. I think a perfect parallel to that, and you start talking about phone, right, is unknown numbers when you get a call. I'll say, like, when my phone rings and I see who it is, then I'll make a decision whether or not to answer based on what I'm doing, how busy I am, and if I know it's going to be a long conversation or whatever. If I truly don't know the number, I'll answer it 100% of the time. I mean, unless I'm on a ladder, you know, holding a drill or something like that. But I'll always answer it.
Wait, if you don't know who it is?
That's right.
Or if you do know. You don't know who it is, you answer the phone? Or
Yeah, I answer the unknown numbers. I do.
What?
Well, I mean,
how's that working out for you?
Yeah, great. Jerry.
Opportunity knocks, you know? You never know who's trying to reach out. And I you know, there's a lot of, you know, it takes about 1,200 milliseconds to know the call's being rerouted to an offshore desk that's pretending to be in Atlanta, and then screw that. And probably 90% of them are like that. It's split between that and the wholesale mortgage folks, right? Are you interested in selling the property? You're like, what property? I don't know. It just says property. Are you interested in selling or not?
Well, no, I mean,
what the
I
heck are you doing, Jerry? That's like living to be the loca, man.
Do you have enough extended warranty in your car for the rest of its life?
Oh, yeah. Then it was
no.
Well, so merging those two, the day before, I got this unknown number. Hey, yeah, this is the tire shop. Your wife's trying to pick up the car and you turned it in. Is that cool? Yeah, it is. I'm really glad I answered the phone. Wouldn't want to leave her stranded standing there.
Wait a minute, Jerry.
It's legit.
I just let it go to voicemail.
Well, what about when it's your kid? And first of all, who has voicemail? That's even that they want.
No. But if it goes to voice message, you can actually you don't even have to listen to it. You can actually look at it and
this is your daughter, and I'm a kid, so I don't have a phone, and I'm borrowing a stranger's, and I have a flat tire on my bike, and like
Jerry, if you were a stock, if you were a publicly traded stock right now, your stock would be dropping in my view.
I'm Cracker Barrel,
man.
And I changed my name.
Exactly, man.
Oh man! All right, let's. I swear that's cyber related, but look, since our last recording, Black Hat happened. I think a lot of people that wonder where we went think that we're all lost in the desert in Vegas on one of those driving dune buggies while shooting machine guns ventures, but we weren't. But we did want to have some talk about some takeaways from there. I know, first of all, super close to home for all of us, Tilson, our producer, took home a $10,000 prize, and he still came back to record for us. Thank you, Tilson. So that was fantastic.
Wait, hold on, let's be clear.
Get in there.
He didn't gamble and get $10,000. He competed and won $10,000.
That's right. In the cybersecurity realm, because even our producers are cyber experts here, right? One of my guys on the adversarial risk management team, our first hire, original engineer, who some of you guys have met, Daniel Gallops. He's a cybersecurity graduate, major wise, but this is his first job right out of college, and he's a software engineer. So all that to say, he's not like a career cyber guy. And he won a malware authoring contest to evade, EDRs. He apparently evaded every single EDR every single time. And it may be because he's never worked with an EDR in his life. It's great. He just used common sense. And
Was it any vibe coding involved?
No. No, he totally would have said that if it was. He writes Rust all day, every day. And whenever he's not typing, it's because he's talking about how much he loves coding. And so if somebody asks him to do something and write a daemon and move data or anything else like that, it's second nature for him to start ripping. So it was cool. And then close home here. So Atlanta/Georgia Tech, 2-year-long Grand AI Cyber Challenge. The team Atlanta, led by a professor at Georgia Tech in my School of Cybersecurity and Privacy, took home the $4 million prize. Wow. That's really cool. So it was, whatever you want to call it, Hacker Summer Camp is turning into a bit of a haul.
Wow.
All for my competition. So that's great. So what else happened at Black Hat? A number of announcements, as always. I think if there's any particular theme, though, sadly enough, it's a number of them are kind of reinforcing this hype cycle problem that I think we have in cybersecurity. So some of the things that we saw come out, there was a story about passkeys being thwarted and that passkeys can be stolen. And anytime there's a headline like that, you really have to jump on it as a security practitioner, right? You got to make sure that you're up to speed and see what's going on. So you're burning cycles here.
Well, especially if it's being presented at a major conference like Black Hat or DEF CON, right?
Yeah. I mean, does that offer credence? Is that a stamp of, you know, this is worth paying attention to?
It's effectively our equivalent of a refereed journal. Right. So if you are publishing a scientific paper, you in theory publish it to a refereed journal where you have a peer review. And effectively, that's what we're kind of within the security industry. We're kind of expecting that through some of these conferences that we have as well.
But all of the, I mean, what you just described is like the academic approach in publishing in journals. And I think that's totally true in materials science and hopefully in healthcare. But in cyber, like I always wrestle with this because my colleagues at Georgia Tech are doing research in cybersecurity. It seems like an industry where research is asymmetrically promoted and funded because of the marketing angle. And I would guess 80-90% of the talks at Black Hat have some commercial win by getting on the stage, and right,
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, is it? I mean, Jay, I don't think there's anything wrong. I like the idea that, yeah, okay, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You have research that you publish. If it's legit, if it's applicable, so what? So what if there's a commercial angle to it?
No, it definitely is a problem if, for example, ExxonMobil publishes articles about why climate change is not happening.
Okay. They do that all the time, Jerry. I mean, it's new.
But then...
Well, so all these security companies are publishing articles about how you're going to die unless you, you know, buy some browser extension or up your security.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think part of the issue is, first, full disclosure, hey, this research was funded by ExxonMobil.
Yeah.
You can, you know, let people make a decision based on that. But some of these are not necessarily always that clear, that there is that vested interest that may be influencing the nature of the research. That said, I mean, the reality for our industry is that we have a lot of security researchers that cannot really operate independently anymore just because they have to make a living. Uh-huh. And the security vendor industry can supply create a reason for these folks to continue to what they do and to make a living. And if they happen to find a vulnerability or an issue that is related to the core product that they're building, great. If they're not, and it's somewhat ancillary, I would hope that security companies, and we do this too, by the way, we support just the discovery of any interesting security vulnerability, regardless of whether it deals with our product or not. I think like Google, Project Zero is a great example of that. Like, it doesn't really matter whether it's a Google vulnerability or not. They just go and find issues across the industry, across any product, And that kind of security research is what we want to continue to incentivize.
So, I mean, not to bring it to political things, but I often go there. But I wish our senators and our representatives would be like NASCAR drivers, and they would just have like the people that are paying for them or supporting their campaign as stickers.
Yeah.
And the bigger the stickers, the more money you give that senator or representative. And I think that's fine. It's okay to be transparent about that. I agree with you, Sunil, that some of these research documents, if there's a commercial angle, just call it. We pay this. We company did this. But there might be a value in the research. I think what you're just saying is just be transparent about it. And I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I don't want to bring it back to the passkey vulnerability, fake news, vapor stuff. But a lot of these companies have done this through years. And I think we all hate it. We all hate when these people create fluff out of nothing and they try to create drama out of nothing. But if it wasn't working commercially, wouldn't they stop doing it?
Yeah.
Because I personally would not want to buy the product. I honestly, when I see stuff like that, you got a tainted mark on you, man. You know, I don't want to use that product, that company. And I won't forget. But well, I may be the exception, Jerry.
I think there's two classes of conflict in misincentivized research. And one is misinformation, kind of the ExxonMobil thing. Like, let's just push people into some fear or something that will drive them towards needing more of what we happen to be selling. So that's definitely real. And then the other is just all news is good news and just get our name there. And that's a little bit different. And we've seen a little bit of that. And in that case, you don't need them to plaster it because they always make sure the name is there, right? And then all of the outlets that carry it, it has the name like six times because that's the way that the article is meant to be written, right? And it's Mario X has published research about this, blah, 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 Mario X. You know, you could see that just pumping. But like two of the stories that came out, they're all like, well, you said a friend of yours, Mario, said something like a headline that water is wet, like just kind of the obvious. So one of these things was saying they're both like we saw two articles that we talked about a good bit, and they were both attacking FIDO and passkeys. And the idea and neither of them, well, both of them were attracting the attention of like cryptographic breakthrough. There's a problem. Uh-oh.
Both a bypass of FIDO.
Yeah, I mean, that would be news, right? But if both of them were like, if you don't use it right, that kind of thing. And one of them was system by default had a, so let's just call FIDO man-in-the-middle resistant MFA. That's kind of why it's cool, why it's useful, why we use it. And it was basically saying there was a failback that was not not man-in-the-middle resistant. And so the attackers would just not attack the passkey, not attack the authenticator, and just realize that there's another way you could do it. So the problem there has nothing to do with the protocols or with the cryptography at all, right? It's a downgrade attack. To me, the takeaway on that one is thanks for reminding us, use that during a red team activity and a company should learn from it and eliminate the downgrades. But it's not a justification for your name being plastered around everywhere. It's a brilliant security research org. But downgrade attacks, the weakest link is the only one that a bad guy would target. And as security pros, I see it over and over again that we invest in something amazing and gold-plated and some kind of control. And, you know, it works for a long time because there's nobody targeting. But when somebody's actually targeting a red teamer or an adversary, they never go straight at the gate, right? They look for the back door. And I would just say, like, the litmus test is, if your CFO or equivalent can't get locked out of their computer and unable to access data until they physically walk in an office 3 days later after a flight, if that's not a scenario that actually could unfold, then you don't really have an authentication control, for example, right? If there's always it's the CFO, we have to let them in, we have to bounce the password, we have to, then that's what I'm going after if I'm the adversary 100% of the time. And that's the only control that matters. Like, to quit talking about quantum. Like, it's
I think at the end of the day, a downgrade attack is a process, an attack against our overall processes. There's a technology that we have that meets a certain threshold, but we always have to consider that technology failing for a number of reasons. And thus having to have a downgrade. I think the challenge with any downgrade attack, which you have to allow in some respect, is the revisiting of that failure point to say, okay, we allowed it for this short period of time because you needed to get your job done. We needed to do something, but let's immediately revisit it 3 days for when you actually show up in the office. And if you don't show up in the office, we revert it back to whatever the previous state was. Yeah, so yeah, it has to be time-bounded. But at the end of the day, and heavily presumably heavily monitored once you've gone to a point where you've allowed it to be downgraded. But the reality is we can't ever avoid downgrades because it is too business impacting. We have to allow the downgrades to occur and monitor what happens subsequently after that.
Have you guys ever seen any report on the financial impact of a downgrade annually or throughout 5 year, 10 year? You know, what is the downgrade impact of the attack, a successful attack? And we'll say, okay, it was 5, 10, 50 million, whatever that is. And then if we had to enforce no downgrade, we say we prohibit downgrade, what would be the financial impact to the company itself of doing business? How impact? And I would love to, does anybody know that?
I think that's the question.
Hold on. I mean, I think we kind of generally know the answer to that, which is just about all the ransomware attacks of recent past that deal with calling into the help desk and convince and social engineering them to perform essentially what is a downgrade. Mm-hmm. Yep. Those are all downgrade attacks.
Yeah. But what's a total on that? And then saying, let's say we prohibit downgrades from ever happening. Because I love to do that, right? I mean, we spend all that money on FIDO2. We spend all this money on zero trust, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But the minute your CFO can't get his work done or she can't get her work done, they're out for 3 days, they can't work. How much money are we talking about, the impact?
Nothing. It's fine. It's just that person who finally got to thump their chest didn't get to thump it for a day, and they're really upset now.
I think the challenge here is if you go with a policy that doesn't allow the downgrade, you're effectively, you have a known quantity of downtime that you're actually creating. You're saying, I'm putting this person out of business for X period of time. At the challenge that we have in the security industry is that we are, we don't know if someone's going to take advantage of that. It's another, very probabilistic. The probability calculations of the likelihood of that happening is much, much more ambiguous. And so it's a situation of, we know when we have a certain policy that prevents downgrades, it's going to cause business impact. And just the number of help desk calls that you've gotten is testament to that.
Yeah. Right? Well, maybe this will trigger something in you, Sunil, and you'll rattle off some stats instantly because you're a walking encyclopedia. But there's been psychological tests, right, that are like, hey, would you rather have a 10% chance of getting $100,000 or take $100?
Yeah.
Right. And people take the quick, the sure thing, even though mathematically the alternative would have been worth 10x. Right? And that's exactly what we're talking about, isn't it?
It's loss aversion. Yeah. Kahneman's prospect theory and loss aversion.
Told you he would have that. So. Well, to me, a takeaway on a lot of this, and what I was talking about with the chest thumping in particular, is I think the only defense against this kind of thing is tone at the top, right? And, you know, I remember like literally our CFO at ICE he'd answer the phone for unknown callers. And I remember people would call him up, hey, is this wire request real or not? And he'd say, no, of course not. No, thank you for calling. He wouldn't be a jerk. He wouldn't say, how dare you call me? I'm the CFO. He wouldn't put him through his secretary because the CFO doesn't answer the phone. That hierarchicalism is just an enemy of security. So I think you got to invite inquiry, challenge, and be willing to dog food it and accept the same controls that you expect the rest of the staff to adopt. All right, switching gears here, going through the news a little bit. So at some point since our last episode, there was some news out about Zelle, and in particular, that there is a lawsuit from New York saying that their negligence in security controls allowed people to make missteps in the Zelle payments platform, resulting in $1 billion of consumer fraud losses, and they want to hold their feet to the fire. What do we know about this? Are they negligent? Are they more negligent or more likely to be negligent than the Venmos and PayPals of the world that preceded them by 20 years?
So let me frame this in a slightly different way, which will help us process this issue. So there's something called Section 230. For those in the who work for a big tech company, most of y'all know what that is. But for those who don't, Section 230 is the clause within the Communications Decency Act that basically separates out the responsibilities of content providers. Companies like Facebook and Twitter, who don't actually create content, but they are the transport for content. Okay, and Section 230 provides immunity to liability and litigation and stuff around harmful content or people getting potentially defrauded or abused or all the harms that we know in social media. And the question here is, to what degree does the concept of Section 230 apply to banking? And what essentially Zelle is, for those who aren't familiar, it's essentially a transport mechanism for moving money. And if someone is defrauded because of, frankly, their own fault, should the banks be liable for that?
And talk about your own fault. Like, what's the pattern or the kill chain here that people are doing that some people would argue that, fintech should be protecting them from? What's the kind of
action? So ultimately the fraud occurs through many different mechanisms. For example, rom-com, but that's not the right word. There's pig butchering, there's romance scams, there's all these different types of ways that people convince others to send money to them. The challenge here, or the problem that I think is being brought up with Zelle, is that the banks at some point in time recognize that this recipient is a fraudster. So is it the bank's responsibility to kick off this fraudster and to say, hey, we should get rid of this, we should not allow this person to continue to do banking through Zelle? That's the argument that essentially the Attorney General is making. But let's apply that same concept again to Section 230 and say, what are the responsibilities of internet service providers or of Twitter and Facebook and YouTube when it comes to kicking off some of these bad actors? And generally speaking, from a societal standpoint, we do expect that from some of these content providers or these content transport providers. But it's the same basic issue. Like, where's the separation of who should actually own this problem? How should this problem be addressed? And who's supposed to take action on addressing these issues? It's a common repeating pattern that we've seen when it comes to those who operate the transport environments or the networks, versus those who want to impose liability on those same providers because of the harms that come out as a result of all that.
Yeah, and this isn't limited to financial services, right? It's any kind of transport medium, if you will. But one of the things that we see repeatedly, you don't have to. I used to say, like, never legislate when you can humiliate. And you don't have to. This isn't just about where someone is legally liable for something. Companies all the time eat loss. I mean, Amazon returns, right? Or it started brick and mortar with Walmart. This new idea that people are taking things back just for customer goodwill. And you might argue that it clearly is worth it, right? People eat a lot of losses and it improves their reputation. People want to use that company more. And that's certainly the case with a lot of banking platforms, where someone does something that's a little bit negligent on their own, but they report fraud loss. There's a lot of situations. I mean, almost all of the, whether it's crypto or other platforms, when people are credited, there's almost always some legal ground they could stand on and say, no, you made a mistake. You got phished. You got hacked. But more often than not, you see people refunding money or splitting the difference. And I like the idea where if it's possible to let the market drive this and just so that common sense and customer service drive it and say, well, we're going to We're going to make people whole, and then we're going to try to fix and improve our security controls and help the consumers help themselves so that we're eating less fraud loss in the future. And I prefer that outcome than having to legislate this and split hairs over lawyers.
Yeah, well, and I think that's a real difference that we see in Europe versus the U.S., where who eats the fraud losses really drives different sets of incentives. Yeah. Around fraud controls and the actions that they take against it.
And well, how do things play out in Europe more?
Well, like to your point earlier, we have a situation where in the U.S., consumers are don't have to pay for credit card transactions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Credit card.
And so as a result of that sort of we incentivize a set of fraud to happen up to a certain point. I forget the exact laws of who owns liability in Europe, but the one of the things that is imposed upon providers in Europe is that the banks and the issuers and such, they take on more of the fraud liability. So what does that drive? Well, it drives a couple things. One, it forces everyone to have to use a PIN. Okay,
yeah.
which is cumbersome, but everyone in Europe has gotten used to it, and that becomes a standard of practice. So anyway, it drives different types of behaviors and different types of incentives, yeah. And ultimately, it is driven by both laws that we pass, but also by, I think, to your point, what we as a society want to name and shame, so to speak.
Market. Well, you know, so I'm going to put a contrarian a little bit on this. But if Zelle, if I'm a customer of Zelle and I'm calling them, hey, I just got defrauded. I got, I lost money because of a fraud event. And okay, it's one person, but then they start seeing patterns when it's happening more and more. And these folks are contacting. These folks are not big companies, potentially. They're just regular people like us, and they don't have these huge amounts of money where they can bring lawsuits themselves directly, but they do notify the Zelles of the world, and they say, look, this has happened, but Zelle doesn't do anything necessarily to kill those accounts. Then sometimes you might need the government to step in if Zelle's not that, right?
Well, I mean, to make it real, let's say that they default to requiring multi-factor authentication, but they allow people to turn it off. And when people turn it off, they say single factor, and they start getting a rash of people that have just like info stealer, and they're getting their single factor credentials and they're stealing money. They're doing that like crazy. And this isn't Zelle, right? This is just a hypothetical here. And to your point, now they see a rash of this. A lot of people are getting taken, and then they're not eating loss, this provider, okay? So there is getting passed on to people, and they're saying, whoa, you turned off the thing. And you're using a single-factor authentication. You're doing it on a machine that you're not maintaining the security of. It's got info stealer. It's your fault over and over again. But each one of those individual users went out of their way to turn off the security thing. They're using sloppy machines, this, that, and the other. You feel that after the, 100,000 of these in a row, or after $1 billion in losses, that they share some liability at the provider, and that they should, that they could be sued for not forcing people to leave on the multifactor? Is that what you're saying, that company is in the wrong, Mario?
If you decide to not wear your seatbelt while you're driving, and you decide to take risk, maybe you're drunk and you're driving, why am I going to sue that company for taking risky action by removing, not putting my seatbelt? Look, if you don't want to use MFA, we gave you the option to do MFA and you reduce it, come back and be blamed for saying, well, you had the capabilities of downgrading this thing, right? We talk about this downgrade again. You took the initiative, Mr. Customer. It was in your control. You decided to do that. Now, one could argue is, well, I did not know what I was doing. Well, okay.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about here is people intention when the customer has done the right thing, try to do the right thing, and they've notified the vendor and says, hey, this is happening. This is a fraud. I've done everything. And it's not just one individual, but hundreds of individuals.
Yeah.
There's some responsibility on the company. Downgrading, intentionally downgrading or not leveraging MFA, this reminds you of a company I used to work at, right? That's not right.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. You know?
But it's a continuum. I think like the CFPB, this is probably what they're dealing with every day, is like trying to figure out along that spectrum how much is negligence on behalf of the consumer versus the institution? And it's not black and white. All right, pivoting into our regular segment on cybersecurity industry. I'm just kidding. We don't have a regular segment on that, but it seems like it. A few deals in the time that we've been that we've had a few things going on here. So Palo buying CyberArk. That's, you know, that news is a little bit older now, but it's showing some activity and some consolidation in the industry. We just heard about CrowdStrike making an acquisition to help their SIEM offering, and Okta doing a deal for Identity and Axiom. And is the market continuing to heat up here? Is this cyber? Is it AI?
Well, by the way, one other company that made the news just this past week is Netskope going IPO. One of
right.
the few
right.
Cybersecurity companies that have made the path all the way to IPO. So congratulations to Sanjay and his team for sticking with it and getting to this point. The I think in terms of M&A, both mergers and acquisitions as well as going public, it's exciting times for companies that have been waiting for those opportunities. And so it does indicate at least a loosening of the market signals in the market suggest that this is good times for cybersecurity to go to have these kind of nice liquidity events.
I think in public equities, we certainly see cyber stocks leading a pretty boisterous market as it is anyway. But our old friend CrowdStrike has been performing strongly and Cloudflare as well. So, I think people are taking money off the sidelines and continuing to invest it. I don't know that's going to last much longer, but we're at a bit of a peak right now. And a lot of that is the benefits going to cybersecurity for sure, whenever it's not AI.
I think I look at these acquisitions as, is it complementary? And I think we talked about this in the past. Is it complementary to a space a company's already in or has invested? Is this an evolution, natural evolution? With CrowdStrike, they got into this whole data analytics. They bought a company, when I was at Snowflake, they bought a company like 5-6 years ago and doing more data analytics for security events, right? So this to me, the acquisition of Onum makes sense because they continue. Everybody realizes it's great to have all these SIEM products, but if the data is garbage, you don't control the data, you don't manage the data, you don't make it usable, then you're just going to get garbage. It doesn't matter if you're using AI or every freaking smart people, if the data's garbage, it's bad. So kudos to CrowdStrike. I'm still on the Palo Alto and CyberArk. It's just, I don't get it.
An odd pairing.
Yeah, I don't get where that's right.
Well, I want to riff on the CrowdStrike thing before you leave that, okay? Because I've been dealing with that a lot lately, and we spend a lot of time with kind of the mid-market, and coming from an enterprise background, I'm seeing a lot of, like, in the real world, companies have enough money to start thinking about security, but not enough of a threat profile to just, you know, iterate and make sure every single loop is covered. You start out as a startup with no EDR, right? And nothing on an endpoint. Actually, you start out without having endpoints. And then there's some place, and I think it's if you have sensitive data in particular, where you require managed devices. And then if you are successful in that and actually making people use the managed devices, then you need to think, okay, well, great. We got them using our laptops. Why? What's so great about our laptops? And then you start thinking about the control stack and like, okay, well, our laptops are better because they have EDR or whatever it's going to be. And then you buy CrowdStrike. And by the way, a lot of companies don't do it in that order at all. They start out by buying CrowdStrike, but everybody can use their home computers. It's kind of dumb, right? Don't invest in these laptops if people aren't actually going to be using them. But what I've noticed is once you get CrowdStrike, SentinelOne, any of these on there, the next step up is to have an MDR, have someone actually managing the alerts and letting you know it's a good thing you got CrowdStrike and all those endpoints because last night at 2 a.m., right now it's 2 a.m. and we think something crazy is going on one. In that gap, though, between when you buy EDR and when you add on the managed service, I just looking into it, I find it's pretty concerning in that those things are so noisy that without an MDR, I don't know that an end user company can really get good value out of an EDR, out of a CrowdStrike or SentinelOne. If they try to wade through the alerts themselves, I think they give up after about 2 weeks and start ignoring everything. It's just kind of a a mess out there. And like when we were looking at like automating and pulling some of these alerts and all that, and the conclusion is what you really want to do is pull post MDR cases from a SOC that's processed it. But to actually pull live events and try to make sense of them is Sisyphean.
So some perspectives I have on the CrowdStrike one versus the Palo Alto one. What I like about CrowdStrike's acquisition strategy is that they have a very systematic approach that demonstrates benefit to their core product very directly. So I think, Mario, the company that you might have mentioned a little while ago was Humio. CrowdStrike acquired Humio because, if I recall, one of the key things that Humio provided was an ability to query a vast amount of data very quickly and in a very short periods of time. Well, that's a core problem that CrowdStrike has of its own. It's its own problem, right? You have this vast amount of data, and now we need to be able to query it. How can I query it very fast? And there's a company that was able to solve that problem. So it made sense for CrowdStrike to acquire that company because it directly contributed to their ability to do the thing that we buy them for. We have all this other data coming from all these different sources, and you have these data pipeline companies. And my perspective is there may be a story that they have around agentic SOC and all that kind of stuff, but really, I can imagine the happiest people at CrowdStrike are the people who struggle with this problem today and within their own internal system because they're consuming all this data from all these different sources and they need a way to manage that pipeline.
It just reminded me when I was at Snowflake and we were moving ourselves from a traditional SIEM to using Snowflake as our solution for our SIEM. And this is years ago. Obviously writing the right searches, collecting the right data, blah, blah, blah. That was important. But we always went back to the original problem was how do we bring in the data from different places and how do we make sense of it before it goes into our, in the case, Snowflake. I think CrowdStrike probably experienced this problem, like what you're saying, Sunil, that they had this great tool. I forget the name of the company that you mentioned, but it was great for analyzing things, analyzing a lot of data, very powerful. But they went back to the beginning, the data is to bring the data in. And a lot of errors, a lot of problems exist there. So I think they've learned that. And I think they realize this is a problem, not just CrowdStrike problem, but it's a problem to the whole industry, I would say.
The average company that's in this and nobody's happy with their SIEM, right? I mean, there's a lot of startups that continue to come out in the space because they all can sense the pain point. But yeah, I mean, you nailed it, Mario, and I know exactly what you're talking about because I live that life too, where like, okay, we're going to have a data lake. We're going to get all the data in here. What are the sources we're going to have? How are we going to transform all them? If we somehow get it right, then that vendor's going to change their spec and everything's going to break and we're not going to know for 6 months. But that's another problem with it. What I think is compelling for a CrowdStrike is when you go through that and you make a data lake, there's always one to three products that dominate the data, right? There's always one to three of the noisiest things that are consuming the majority of the resource.
And your EDR, like you said.
And the EDR is number one. That's right. And it's going to be, especially if it's like doing process monitoring and you get that all in there, that's going to be all it. So I think the angle for them is to say, like, if you use us for SIEM, we guarantee we're going to get the EDR data right, right? And then you just think, well, cool. And the question for a buyer becomes, is it better to make sure you got the noisiest thing nailed down pat and maybe not have your Zscaler in there yet and not have your Okta in there and certainly not have your bespoke internal apps in there? Or is it better to kind of shoot for the moon and say, no, I'm going to make sure I get everything right? And I see more and more people will go towards that. Look, they got it covered. Let's use them for the SIEM. And they can take third-party sources into the SIEM. CrowdStrike can do that. Yeah. They're going to wrestle like the rest of us with having to keep up with the changes in the formats and that sort of thing. And that's where this investment they made was. So to your point, it's making sense. It's congruent.
Yeah. I do want to bring it back to something you said, though, about startups and their natural progression of acquiring security tool or security expertise. I think that's what you're kind of hinting on. I'm just going to say from my own journey, we're still in stealth mode. And yes, I obviously I'm a CISO and I believe in security. It's in my veins. But on day one, we partnered up with an MSSP that had a modern stack for security tooling. And we decided to just offload that on the endpoint as we focus in production, our core product, and let them manage our CrowdStrike, because that's their core competency, manage their the island browser, enterprise browser, whatever browser cool. You want to talk about. So you can take advantage of these MSSPs and partner up with them, at least for your first year or 2 years, to handle a lot of your security stuff if they're good, if they're worth their dime. So I'm not pitching MSSPs. I'm just telling you the reality to say, well, I'm not going to buy this product yet. I'm going to wait and see what happens. I let me just say, with an MSSP, we have over 10 to 14 employees. You're paying $45,000 a year for a full security stack total. Think about that. Even if you try to outsource it to a different country, you're paying the same amount of money. But these folks are giving you 24/7, fully stacked, fully monitoring, doing all that stuff. So I think we should revisit that if you're a startup.
And that's including tools and licenses and that sort of
yes.
thing?
Yes, 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 yeah. Right? I mean, now, look, to your point, I mean, there's they include something like ThreatLocker. It's just a pain in the ass. When you have a new company and you're installing new applications, you're going to get a warning all the time. And if you have it set up in blocking mode, you're not going to have people being productive. So leave it in monitoring. Learn from it. You know, so when you're initially a young company testing out new products, building new products, you may want to leave this tooling in monitoring mode only, unless for the really rare exceptions.
It's tough, right? There is such a massive gravitational pull to turning off security controls in general. And for startups, I think it's worse than anything because, you know, you got the same person who either has to, let's talk about like WAF, right? We're all in web-facing tools here. SaaS, we all know WAF, really important, great. WAF breaks stuff like crazy. And 9 times out of 10, the solution is to turn it off. I mean, no one admits that. They don't really turn it off. They put in a little rule that turns it off. It's the same thing, right? Bypass it for almost everything. And it takes so much diligence and self-discipline to say, no, 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 we're going to spend 90 minutes straight testing and regression testing and all of that to make sure this is right versus just doing a whitelist or something like that. It's really tough. And the monitoring mode thing is correct, but somebody has to go through those logs. And if that person's also your bookkeeper and your chief salesperson and your network architect, that might not make, you know, it's tough. Hey, I have a lot of sympathy for startups and security.
This quick public service announcement for, these aren't really for startups, but shocker, there's a Citrix NetScaler vulnerability out there this past week, I think. Put a WAF in front of it. Put a WAF in front of your Citrix NetScalers, because you'll that will clean up a vast majority of your attack surface, and you won't have to worry so much whenever the next vulnerability comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think almost nobody has a WAF as a startup until they get a TPRM request from their customer that says, do you have a WAF? And then they get the WAF and it breaks stuff. And then they disable all the rules and they think, why do we have a WAF again? For Bank of America's questionnaire, do we still satisfy it? Yeah, we still have a WAF. Oh, well, hell, what are we doing here? Let's win. It's a win-win. We're passing the questionnaire and we're not blocking prod anymore. That's real life. And
I've maybe debate this WAF thing, because honestly, every time I see a WAF, I'm like, ah, you freaking people. It's ridiculous. What a waste of time. No, it really, Sunil, you highlight a very important point, a very obvious point there on that one. But how do you, I had to manage Mott Security. I lived through Mott Security, the original WAF, and it's just god awful and it hasn't improved. Jerry's right. You're going to ultimately reduce what you're monitoring and blocking for, or else you're going to break business.
All right. So here's the general principle I operate on. It's this notion of bounded versus unbounded. Mm. When you have a bounded environment, when you know you have a situation where it's very bounded and the type of activities you expect
is very predictable.
Right. So a Citrix NetScaler device is a very bounded environment. You should never see a web shell. There's like a zero reason for a web shell.
I agree.
And so you just
agree.
Remove that as a complete part of your attack surface.
I don't know. I mean, first of all, you can break TLS in front of a VPN concentrator like that reliably. Like, I bet most people with a WAF in front of them aren't even able to see anything enough to know they were going for a web shell.
So anyway, well, the general point being, in bounded environments, creating a rule set that just removes anything that's outside of those bounds is a good general practice.
That's tough.
When it's unbounded, I would not put a WAF, or I would not put any. Yeah. I would do exactly what Mario's saying in terms of keeping the monitor mode, because you definitely don't want to block anything, because what you will block will more than likely be some sort of legitimate business.
Monitoring mode's tough, I tell you. Yeah, I mean, cybersecurity tool. So where people are uploading often CSV files full of old stuff, right? Risk register type things, vulnerability databases, like all the CSPM findings. And if you think about like what those findings look like in a narrative format, like imagine doing an export out of Wiz of all your findings, and then imagine what that looks like. It's describing in the Wiz write-ups exploits. It's saying, you know, we see traffic to, and it's showing a string that looks like an exploit attempt. You put that through a WAF, it's going to go nuts like a Christmas tree, because it looks like every exploit in the world is going off. So, but still, I would have called it a bounded system.
No, it's not. It's not a bounded, because the inputs are unbounded.
That's right.
The input, nature of the content is an unbounded state. So you have to come up with a way to then subsequently bound it. Right. You have to come up with ways to carve it out and say, look, I'm okay with this part being accepted as is, and these parts you treat entirely differently.
So to follow up on that unbounded stuff, I have a visceral reaction to WAF is because, and the reason is, besides the fact that I had to manage Mutt security at one point, is that most of the challenges between when I was a Snowflake and signing up a contract with a customer was because the customer was demanding, as part of doing business with them, that we put a WAF in front of, you know, their Snowflake account. And I had to, I won all these arguments eventually. Not that I'm trying to kudo myself here, but it was the whole unbounded thing that Sunil was saying. What do you think a database is? What do you think is going to have all these SQL commands?
That's right.
What do you think a WAF is going to look at? It's going to say, oh my God, there's a SQL injection here or SQL this and that. It's a freaking database, man. And everybody has, and if it's a multi-tenant database, you put a WAF in front of a multi-tenant database, it's uber unbounded. You're just going to get alerted, block traffic. It's awful.
Yeah. So, yeah. I know. I mean, I hear what you're saying too, Sunil, right? You have certain endpoints where you have unstructured data and then you can ignore those. But all the good thing going to the web server doesn't have to have SQL injection. You could block that. And there's a balancing act. Yeah. All right. Time to talk about AI. So I think the big news on a lot of podcasts and discussions and blogs and everything else over the last, 7 to 10 days has been an MIT report saying that like Gen AI pilots are failing, and then knocks into some really good conversations. So, you know, I wanted to get a take on that. I mean, I definitely see a lot of companies trying to over-index on AI right now, like rewarding employees for using AI, penalizing them for not using AI. So I definitely see a rush towards this, and I see a lot of people that would normally have written a paragraph email now are writing a 26-page report because AI is writing it for them. And the people who used to read paragraph are now using AI to consume a 26-page report and write their reaction to it. And it's kind of squeezing the humans out of all this. It's tough to measure, though. Is that a net negative on the business? Is that a net positive on the business? I think the jury's out, but I'm not surprised that people aren't immediately profiting because of the introduction of AI. And I think that's okay. I think it's early days, and this doesn't render a negative verdict. And I think we still have a lot of potential here. Is that your take too? That this is like, of course they're not realizing yet, but they will. And so they're right to be experimenting, or do you feel like people are expecting too much out of AI right now?
So a couple things, there are a couple things to be mindful of. First is, you just used the word experiment, and I think we have to recognize that most of these are indeed experiments. They're not like proven outcomes or use cases that we know will repeatedly produce a positive outcome. And so first is just to recognize, when you look at experiments, you should expect actually maybe one out of 20 experiments to fail, okay, as a general statement. So that's one data point. The second data point I would throw out is, let's consider the base rate for just IT projects in general failing. And if you look at the industry writ large, it's something like 70 to 80% of IT projects fail, okay, which is a pretty huge number to begin with. So 95% of AI projects being failing. Actually, when you consider that at the upper end, 80% of IT projects fail, 95% of AI projects failing, maybe not so much. Maybe not be, it may not be that bad. And the third point I want to bring up is there was a McKinsey study that also came out earlier this month, and it was about what they call horizontal versus vertical use cases. So vertical use cases are those that are usually directly tied to some specific business function, usually a revenue-generating business function. And what McKinsey discovered was, or observed, I should say, is that the revenue-generating use cases had a more observable ROI compared to horizontal use cases, which are more back-office functions like enterprise search, for which it was really hard to quantify ROI. Well, this is another one of those, you just prove water is wet. Of course it's hard. It's really hard to prove out the enterprise search ROI because it's just all behind. You don't, there's no revenue tied to it, okay? Okay, so now you take all those three different points together, and we, if you actually read the MIT report, one of the things that they call out is there were no real KPIs or clear metrics of success. Well, if a large part of these generative AI projects were something like rolling out Copilot, well, proving out ROI for an enterprise search use case is extremely hard. Is there ROI? Absolutely, in the sense of people being able to do things much more efficiently. But have you been able to quantify it in dollar values? And the answer is no. And so that's how we end up with these sort of headlines that suggest the sky is falling, but maybe, you know, there's a little bit more behind the scenes here.
You know, as part of being an AI company in stealth mode now, you know, one of the things that I can say is these LLMs are the ultimate politician, right? And how so? They make you sound, they never necessarily disagree with you. And if they disagree with you, they do it in a nice way, or they'll make comments. Wow, that's a really smart thing you said. But forget just about the interaction, the commands that you do, interactions between the LLMs and the human. But the product that they put, Sunil's right. They'll write 24 pages. Sounds wonderful. Like it speaks so well, but it's nonsense. You read the 24 pages and you say, but what did I get out of this? Mm-hmm. What is this telling me? And so if you let these things go run amok by themselves, everybody said this before, I'm not coming up with anything new. They definitely hallucinate. They sound like they're really smart. They sound like, I'm telling you, they're like politicians. They sound great. They agree with you, but they don't say anything. And so you can't just let these things go run wild by themselves. You need to have certain controls. You need to have a human being with some level of experience to say, no, that's wrong. Let's fine tune this. Let's make sure those agents don't go outside of what is expected of their core competency and control that. That, I think, is where a lot of the potential productivity will come out afterwards.
Yeah, and it's not just a matter of, I mean, I think we went into this about productivity, but it also becomes a security protection, right? And the more you're letting things filter, process unbounded input, to Sunil's earlier point, the more likely you're going to be susceptible to prompt injection, for example, right? Because I mean, you don't know what's going to come in. And I mean, ideally, you know, there's been some recent kind of parlor tricks about, like poison calendar invites, because people were using Gemini in this case, but to process mail and calendar invites and do some of the really cool productivity enhancing things that we're hoping Gemini will do. and to come to some prompt injection that was in there. And we hope that these parsers will, you know, have some intelligence to realize when they're taking a prompt versus processing raw data in the future. But in the meantime, we can protect ourselves by just not installing agents and allowing things to just take unbounded input and process it. Are you guys, and I hate for you to self-identify as a target here, but are you guys using AI assistants to the extent of them reading your emails and or calendar invites and being able to automate actions?
The example that you gave with the Google Gemini, I'm trying to remember if that was actually on by default. And so I think that's probably, to your question, Jerry, I think we have to figure out whether or not that's a default setting that is already turned on, or if you have to actively opt in. Obviously, if it's, you have to actively opt in, then it's a much bigger concern. But that said, I think going back to the earlier comment about the MIT report, one of the things that they mention is things that require basically no configuration and you see immediate value are the ones that succeed, okay? And maybe, Jerry, to your point again, the ones that are easiest to configure is just hook it up to my email and then help me manage my day better. And those are the things I think people will say that provides lots of value. Give me meeting summaries. Mm-hmm. Give me all these things that is a toil that makes my day toilsome. And people see value in that. But that creates all the security issues that we just talked about as well.
But it is back to this whole, you know, the impact of AI. You know, I read an article that that it is, again, these recent graduates, these folks who are coming in the industry. We talked about this, but I just read a headline 2 days ago that is the group that's really getting impacted the most. And the ones who are benefiting are those folks with experience, the folks with gray hairs, the scars that we've learned from our past experiences. This is really a detriment to our youth and people graduating from college with good degrees, and they're not getting jobs. And that's what it's saying. That's the impact that we're seeing. And I think that we're not going to realize how impactful negatively until another decade, I think.
So the challenge of any university, and I think anybody who's taught, Jerry, I've taught before as well, and Jerry's teaching now at Georgia Tech, is if you have, unless you have people out in the field leading this next technological revolution, you're usually teaching students patterns of the past and how to be successful in the past economy, so to speak. So that's why we end up with all these students that graduate but don't necessarily have the skills to operate in an AI-driven economy. So I think that's going to be really an interesting challenge for us colleges and the universities that we have, where we have many more students coming in, but they're, to your point, they're leaving without necessarily the skills to compete here.
It's interesting you say that. So I was at an open house yesterday, and kids are back in school. And as I mentioned, or I was talking to you guys earlier before the podcast, every classroom that we visited, every teacher talked about AI. And not only that, and how students should be using it, they're actually teaching students on this is the right way of using it, that we expect you to use it for your papers if you're going to do that. And this is the wrong way. And just to add, this is high school. This is not college, Sunil. So I can't speak with college. But most of those teachers have actually gone this past summer or the previous summer to take classes on the impact of AI and how to think about AI. So these high school teachers are actually getting trained on some of the newer kind of technologies with AI and usage of AI.
Yeah.
So it may be happening in high school. I don't know if it's happening in college, Sunil, to your point.
I think that there's a place for that for sure. I mean, I think that that's a skill set you just have to have. But, you know, Sunil, you pointed out something pretty that kind of tips off something I've observed in my classes. I think I'm in a really weird unicorn situation in teaching in that my course is basically based on all the data out there in the public realm is wrong, and I'm going to teach you what's right, right? And there's a ton of hubris in that, and maybe it's awful and wrong and everything about it, sure. But set that aside for a moment. That means that the LLMs are the enemy here. And so I get upset in the papers because I can totally tell when they went just to an LLM, because it's regurgitating all of our friends and pundits and all the people that we talk about and all these articles that we kind of refute week after week that are polluting the cybersphere with bad news and fake data. And you ask ChatGPT about security, and it's going to tell you the same old dumb stuff about password complexity or whatever else. You can spot it from a mile away. It looks like an auditor report, right? Every time one of my students goes to just GPT, whereas if they're actually studying the material, I mean, I won't say it's directly at odds with it, but there's some very unique things that are not going to come out of GPT, so it stands out.
Yeah.
And as a result, not only can I spot Gen AI usage, but I also find it wrong. Like it's failing totally. the test. If it were Gen AI usage, whether I spot it or not, but if I were teaching chemistry 101, I bet it would be bang on, right? It'd be awesome. It'd probably be better than anything that I would be able to certainly teach. But even in any given Chem 101 class, if you go to an LLM, you're probably taken to the next level because it's going to benefit from, you know, PhD research and on and on. And in that case, it's a different story. Like the answers are always going to be right. And so the question is, are you just missing the opportunity to learn, but you're definitely satisfying the report? That would be even more challenging to try to decide whether you don't like it. And if so, how are you going to detect it and police it? Whereas I have the luxury of it being not only are you kind of phoning it in and using GPT, but you're getting the wrong answers. So I have a better, you know, hill to stand on here. All right, guys. Well, we made up for lost time here for sure. And I'm looking forward to the next episode already because we've got a backlog to work off of hot topics here. But thanks again, as usual, guys. We're right back on schedule. So if you're a regular listener, don't worry. We're not going anywhere. And we'll be back in a fortnight. And otherwise, thanks, guys. And I'll see you on the other side of Labor Day.